You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, conservative firebrand Ann Coulter recently canceled a talk scheduled at UC Berkeley amid the threat of protests. We'll learn about a proposal here in Wisconsin that would protect the free speech of campus speakers and potentially punish disruptive protesters.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Canada recently changed its dairy policy, cutting down on imports, which left some Wisconsin farmers scrambling.
Robert Menser joins us now to share the details of that and other top stories of the past week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday for our state news roundup. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, thanks. Hey, Rob.
Well, let's look at this Canada story. In a nutshell, what happened? Why was it affecting farmers here in the state?
Yes, so we talked about this a couple of years ago. There was this trade dispute with Canada that is complicated, but essentially a bunch of new fees were added to certain types of American dairy exports, and this shut down some share of American sales, especially for those of us in the north part of the United States. So earlier this month, the big Wisconsin dairy buyer, Grassland Dairy, had informed something like 60 farms that Grassland would no longer buy their milk anymore after 30 days. So at that point, there was a very real risk that some of these farms could be forced to shut down. There's an oversupply of milk right now even in the U.S. market, and losing their buyer, it wasn't clear that they would be able to find another.
So these farmers were scrambling to find buyers. What do we know about how successful they've been at doing that since then?
So the news this week is good. The important news here is that almost all of the farms now have buyers, down to just a very few. And it sounds like it was headed in the direction of connecting all of these farms with buyers. The state has been working on finding places for the milk to go, and they've accounted for just about all of them. Now it's not like all good, or it's not solved forever. A lot of these cases, the new contracts are short-term contracts, so there'll be an issue of whether those get renewed. It's certainly not ideal, but it does stave off the possibility that these farms would have to sell their cows and close their doors.
What have we heard from Governor Walker and President Trump on this issue?
Yeah, this was all hands on deck for Wisconsin politicians from Governor Scott Walker and our U.S. senators and people in the Walker administration, and it did attract the attention of the president who talked about this with Walker. For Trump, of course, trade imbalances and just basically the idea that international trade deals are bad for Americans was a signature campaign issue, though less so of a governing issue. But here was a case where the president did jump in. On Tuesday, he tweeted, as he is wont to do. He wrote, "Canada has made business for our dairy farmers in Wisconsin and other border states very difficult. We will not stand for this. Watch." And lo and behold, the Trump administration this week announced new tariffs on certain types of Canadian lumber. So we are in a trade war with Canada, which I do not think I had in the betting pool.
And this is something, I mean, there's talk of renegotiating NAFTA. There's this back and forth over dairy, lumber, who knows what else. This is not going to get resolved fast, I'm guessing.
Yeah. The Prime Minister of Canada, of course, spoke with President Trump this week, and Trump has backed off a plan to sort of immediately blow up and withdraw from NAFTA, another significant trade agreement. So we're not at the apocalypse here, but definitely it's not these are actual tensions and actual actions being taken by both governments. So yeah, it's hard to say where it goes.
Talking to Rob Menser from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the top Wisconsin news of the week. This week, prosecutors started an inquest into the death of an inmate at the Milwaukee County Jail. This is about a year ago. Last April, this happened. On Monday, it was released that the inmate was denied water for 7 days before he died. What are we seeing this week, Rob?
Yeah, and the inquest has continued. There was some news that folks heard at the top of the hour, but essentially this is the county's investigation into the circumstances of Thomas's death in the Milwaukee County Jail. His is one of four deaths in a short period of time that spurred this sort of county-led investigation, and they have not determined yet whether there will be any criminal charges that come out of the case, but the information that has come out of these public hearings this week is pretty horrifying. So Thomas was kept in a solitary confinement cell for 7 days straight, was never left the cell in that week, and in all that time without running water in the cell. Inmates in solitary confinement are not brought drinks with their meals, and so he had no, as far as we know, he had no access to liquid of any kind. He lost 35 pounds in the course of the week, and on the eighth day of his confinement, the jail guards found him dead on the floor of the cell.
Now, some activists in Milwaukee County have said, hey, the buck starts with the guy on top. That's Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark. They've been pressuring Governor Walker to use what apparently is his power to remove a county sheriff. Let's give a listen to what Governor Walker had to say.
I've read some of the stories, but to me, I don't make decisions based upon what I see in stories. I want to look at a scientific report, and I haven't analyzed that, no.
He's also said it's up to the voters to decide on the fate of Sheriff Clark. What do you think, Rob, about the role of Sheriff Clark and continuing concerns about him?
Well, Clark is the sheriff. The jail is his responsibility, and in this case, though it is yet to be established whether there is any, whether there will be criminal charges or whether there is legal culpability for actions in this case, what has been quite clearly established in these inquest hearings is that employees violated jail rules and behaved irresponsibly. The issue here is whether or not that tips into criminal culpability. So, yes, there have been calls for Clark to resign. Clark himself is a high-profile public official, and his main priority sometimes seems to be going on Fox News. He has not himself had much to say about this case, except to say basically that Thomas was a criminal. People can infer what he's implying there, but it's neither here nor there to the fact that the guy died in his in the jail that Clark is in charge of.
Let's move on to another story this week. The Wisconsin Maine Youth Athlete Association, the WIAA, going to be offering concussion insurance for young athletes next year. How will this work?
So yes, beginning next school year, every athlete, that's about 80,000 youth athletes beginning in grade 6 up through high school seniors, will have $25,000 in insurance coverage per head injury. The WIAA, of course, is a body that governs high school sports, youth sports in Wisconsin. And the idea here is this is kind of a supplemental insurance, this is a secondary insurance. They would file a claim with their primary insurer first, but what this $25,000 would do would be cover any co-pays or if people have a deductible. The director's statement here is that the potential cost of medical care should not be the reason that these kids don't get a diagnosis or don't get a follow-up treatment that they need in case of injury playing sports.
And this comes amid concerns about concussions really at all levels, professional on down to Pee Wee football, doesn't it?
Right. So it's pretty clear that this is an issue that parents are nervous about. And you could look at this as the WIAA doing what literally every other organized football organization is trying to do in some sense and soothe people's fears or anxieties about inherent dangers of that sport. Of course, football is not the only sport where kids get concussions, but it is the sport where kids get the most concussions. There's evidence that participation in football has been down in recent years in Wisconsin, but it's also the case that participation in all youth sports has declined somewhat, so it's not very quite clear whether that itself is a response to concussion fears, but I think that is the sort of thing that is on the mind of a body like the WIAA. And so, you know, you could look at this as a move to try to head off some of those concerns.
We'll leave it there for now, Rob. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks so much.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He's with us every Friday for our state news roundup.
Republican legislators yesterday called for more control over protesters on UW campuses. Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is one of the bill's chief sponsors. He said that the goal is to protect freedom of expression from a variety of viewpoints on the state's university campuses.
Opponents to the measure include Democratic lawmakers, the state chapter of the ACLU, and the liberal advocacy group One Wisconsin Now.
Nico Savage joins us now. He's the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he's been following this story. Nico, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Nico, first of all, what's in this bill?
Sure. So the bill lays out a number of requirements for UW system officials. It essentially requires that they pass a new free speech policy that states that the university is open to all ideas and that it's not the role of the university, as they put it, to shield people from opinions that they find unwelcome or even deeply offensive. It then goes further to say that if someone is demonstrating at an event, if there's a protester at a controversial speaker, and that person interferes with that speaker and their free expression rights, it lays out a system whereby they would face discipline from the university. And actually, in one case, if someone violates the policy more than once, if a student did, that student would face at minimum a semester-long suspension and could even be expelled for disrupting those speeches. It also requires that institutions, UW institutions, as it's written now, it says that they would have to remain neutral or strive to remain neutral on public policy controversies, which would conceivably bar those universities from weighing in on various issues.
I know Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has been vocal this year, the last several months, and has called for what he terms intellectual diversity on campuses. And in particular, he thinks that conservative voices aren't getting their equal time on campus. Is this bill part of that same argument?
I think it's similar. It's definitely related to that. You know, more directly, this sort of legislation, which we've seen pop up in several states around the country, and actually the Wisconsin legislation is based on a model bill that was drafted by the Goldwater Institute, which is a conservative group based in Arizona. It's essentially prompted by some of these high-profile incidents, including just this week with Ann Coulter at UC Berkeley, in which conservatives feel that their ideas are shouted down and not presented fairly at university campuses. We've seen examples of this with Coulter and with Milo Yiannopoulos at UC Berkeley, with the political scientist Charles Murray at Middlebury College, and slight version of that at UW-Madison just last fall when a conservative commenter was protested at an event on campus here.
Well, the term, I guess, heckler's veto is sometimes used to describe the circumstances. Play that out. What does it mean if someone is doing a heckler's veto when someone else is trying to speak?
Sure. So the idea is essentially that a demonstrator, by protesting in a disruptive way, can shut down an event by making it impossible for the speaker to give their talk. So if there is a protester in the audience who, say, goes up to the front of the room, takes the mic away, and begins demonstrating, or there's a group of protesters who do that, to the point where that speaker can't talk and that event maybe gets shut down, that's the sort of case of a heckler's veto, as it's known.
How is this being seen as a free speech issue on both sides?
Well, I think the issue that the lawmakers are seeking to address, again, is this feeling that campuses are not open to all viewpoints, and that if someone comes to present ideas, and typically it's conservative ideas in these sort of most high-profile cases that we're seeing get a lot of attention now, feeling is that those people are shouted down, that they don't have the opportunity to present those controversial ideas. So the way the bill's authors say it, This legislation ensures that if someone has an idea, just because it's controversial and just because people might disagree with it and want to protest it, they would not be able to essentially stop that idea from getting out into the public sphere to be debated and discussed freely. On the other side, though, Democrats and some civil liberties groups do take issue with some aspects of the legislation, particularly the mandatory punishments for students who would violate the policy more than once, basically saying that that's overly draconian, I believe, in the words of an ACLU official.
And looking at what the UW response has been, I understand they have said they already have measures in place to deal with this kind of behavior. What is in place currently?
Well, UW does already have policies on free expression. Actually, back in 2015, the Board of Regents passed a statement essentially reaffirming their commitment to free expression and to an open exchange of ideas, including controversial and potentially offensive ideas that, again, was prompted by some of these debates over free speech on college campuses. UW officials say basically we have policies in place for dealing with students who violate our free speech policies. Democratic lawmakers have also noted that, you know, if students are disrupting events in certain ways, that they could also face criminal charges, such as disorderly conduct, if police are involved. So they say that creating new penalties is unnecessary.
We're speaking with Nico Savage right now, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he's talking with us about a new measure proposed by Republican legislators to curtail protests at campus events. They're hoping it could allow for more diversity of positions to be expressed at UW campuses. And looking again at one of the first things you mentioned, Nico, that the bill would also require the university to remain neutral, not take political positions. How is that being seen? Is it being seen as the university needs to be mum on a variety of topics, say from sexual assault to underage drinking, or is this something that the language might be tweaked to make it less specific?
I think there's a high probability of the language being tweaked, because as it reads right now, you're sort of having a situation where some of the bill's authors and some of the advocates for it are kind of describing different things from what they want out of it. The section, I'll read it to you now. It says, at each institution, so each UW institution, shall strive to remain neutral as an institution on the public policy controversies of the day and may not take action in such a way as to require students and faculty to publicly express a given view of social policy. So what they're saying, what author Jesse Kramer says, is that we're telling the university you can't make your employees or your students espouse a certain viewpoint. But the way that that's written right now, that language would appear to say that UW can't take stances on any political controversies of the day, or shall strive to remain neutral on those. And of course, UW often does that. It does so with the state budget. It does so with legislation that would affect the university, such as bills for concealed carry on college campuses. And so it's not clear right now whether the lawmakers will look to, it appears likely right now that lawmakers will look to kind of change that language and make it more clear as to what they're spelling out. Then again, Robin Voss yesterday said that it's not appropriate for the university to take political positions. So it doesn't seem clear right now what the intent of that section is.
So if the university under this law were to go forward, we're no longer allowed, for instance, to lobby legislators, that would represent quite a sea change, wouldn't it?
It would. And again, it would mean on issues like the budget, on issues like some of the bills that had to do with fetal tissue research or concealed carry, or even you could go federally with some of the budget cuts to research funding that were included in President Trump's budget proposal. You know, the university is often weighing in on these sorts of policy issues, and again, as it's written right now, it would appear to say that the university should stay out of those discussions.
And as you said, Nico, some opponents lining up against it, and WPR reporter Laurel White spoke with former University of Wisconsin System President Robert O'Neill, who's now a professor emeritus of law at the University of Virginia, where he specializes in First Amendment law. And here's what he had to say.
Well, the worst part of it is this incredible litany of categories, most of which, as I say, are clearly unconstitutionally vague or imprecise or undefined.
So one opinion there from a former UW system president getting at some issues that need clarification. Are lawmakers seeming to be receptive to the idea that this is a bill that may need to go back and have some revisions?
It sounds like they are. I actually talked with Joe Cohn just today, who's part of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which is sort of a free speech group that was involved in the drafting of this legislation, and he brought up a similar issue, saying that there is this list of categories of speech that are essentially not allowed under this policy that includes boisterous speech or unreasonably loud speech or profane speech, that Cohn was basically saying, well, those are still free speech. Those are not unprotected examples of speech, and essentially said that's something that FIRE, as the group is known, will want to see changed. But the way he put it, it sounds as if they're optimistic that lawmakers are open to those changes and are interested in kind of making some of those smaller tweaks that some of the advocates want to see.
And Nico, have you heard any other official reaction from the UW?
No, well, mostly they've been kind of pointing to the policies and the rules that already exist, and saying that, you know, there are policies on the books for this already, and that they're interested in working with lawmakers in such a way that recognizes basically what they've already got going on.
Nico, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Nico Savage is the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us there to explain a new measure proposed by Republican legislators to curtail protests at campus events. Technology has become an ingrained and crucial part of our day-to-day lives. We rely on phones to wake us up, the internet to do our jobs, and social media to keep us in touch in ways we couldn't have dreamed 20 or 30 years ago. As adults, we're used to this technology, even if we wish we could take a break from it sometimes.
But kids born over the last couple of decades mark the first generations to grow up with the internet, and children today are inundated all over the place by advertising geared specifically towards them. They carry out many of their friendships on social media platforms like Snapchat, and they use technology like it's an extension of themselves. But what effect could this all have on children in the long term, and how can we teach our kids to navigate this high-tech world?
Jessica Taylor Petrowski joins us now. She's an associate professor at the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Amsterdam, and she's also the co-author of the new book, Plugged In, How Media Attract and Affect Youth. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, why is it so hard to pin down the effects of media on children from toddlers to teenagers?
Well, I think you just addressed one of the key points, because as children get older, the effects change. So age is a big factor in this, and actually because children are different. So we know individual differences play a key role in identifying which children are affected by media and how.
That's right, and that's a point you make again and again in your book, that there's not really a one-size-fits-all answer. For example, you know, media makes children violent. Well, every child might react differently. So how do we get a clear handle on what's actually happening? How do you study it?
Well, it's really complicated to study, actually. I think one of the key things is we have to be sensitive to these differences as scientists, and at the beginning really say which kids are more likely to be affected. And we really try to think about these differences in children and really how they process this content differently. But it's really tough for me when parents will say to me, you know, is my child going to be affected by this media? It's never a simple yes or no. And when parents ask me these questions, it's often, how do you see your child responding, and sort of working from that. But it's really a very complex issue, and media is only making it more complicated.
That's right. And you say a lot of the coverage of the effects of the media, it seems like it's negative, and you talk about how the experts that are often quoted in these articles are experts who may work with a very specific child or small group of children who may be the exception and not the norm. So what do you think stories about children in the media get wrong?
Well, we often call this chocolate headlines, this idea that often the media really, the headlines often suggest negative effects of media. And what happens is they tend to get a lot more attention. The if it bleeds, it leads phenomenon often takes over. And what's missing is some of the nuance, and actually highlighting that for many kids, media may have very little effect. And for many kids, actually can have a very positive role in their lives as well. And I would like to see a little bit more balanced coverage. It's not that there are not negative effects. We call these the dark sides of media in our book, but there's also sunny sides as well.
It does seem as though, if you look at sort of the canon of books about children and media coming out recently, past several years, it does seem to veer toward the alarmist side. Attention spans shrinking, children and adults becoming more violent, and communication skills being lost, socialization skills being lost. What happens to the positive side? Is that there too, an equal amount?
Actually, yeah. And a lot of those stories that you hear, those narratives, they're not really... they're cautionary tales in many ways, and I think they're missing the nuance that often these effects are really for very specific subsets of kids. And there's just as many studies to show, for example, that social media can be benefiting children's identity development and friendship formation. We see studies that well-designed educational media can help both in the classroom and at home. We see lots of opportunities of digital gaming for flexible thinking and spatial awareness and 21st century learning skills. So I think a lot of times these alarmist books, unfortunately, they play on fear. And it's not that they're not always true. There are truths to this, but I kind of want to see us move towards a more nuanced perspective and maybe not rely so much on these fear appeals.
Well, a question to kind of start us off, are kids today different than kids were 50 years ago? Are they, for instance, are they growing up faster, maybe in part because of media exposure?
Kids actually are different. This is something we'll hear a lot about, and our research in this book really just does show that different generations of kids, today's generation of kids, are physically larger, which we think has a lot to do with nutrition. They tend to have greater flexible thinking skills, so actually they seem to be more intelligent. And this seems to be potentially linked to digital gaming, for example. And we also see that they may have some indications of being slightly more narcissistic, which we have to discuss in the context of today's society, where some narcissism might actually be healthy. I mean, the selfie is a narcissistic behavior in many ways, yet it's very normal. And we see increased diagnoses of things like depression and ADHD. But again, that actually may be more that we're more sensitive to it than previous generations.
Could it be that we also haven't studied it in this particular way before?
Exactly. We may be, there are so many different ways that this has been measured in the past versus now. It's sometimes a little difficult to compare generations. We do see some differences, but what we also see is that there's perhaps even more differences within this generation of children.
We're talking right now with Jessica Taylor Petrowski. She's an associate professor at the University of Amsterdam, and we're talking about her new book. It's called Plugged In, How Media Attract and Affect Youth. And looking now at very young children, I mean, it used to be that if you looked at kids, let's say, from 0 to 2, they were not media consumers. And then it seems as though there was a kind of a seismic shift that happened. And you, in your book, you talk about the Teletubbies as being sort of this eureka moment when TV executives realize, hey, we can market to these, you know, create programming to these really little kids. How did that change things?
Well, you're absolutely right. This so-called diaper demographic really emerged with things such as Teletubbies, when suddenly there was an opportunity to target this audience and effectively use and merchandise. Merchandising really played a role in showing, hey, you can make money on this. And today we actually see that the starting age for when young children are using media has actually decreased. Some of estimates suggest they might be using some media as early as 4 months of age. And we see this particularly true with the app generation, where there's more apps available for these little ones. And it's certainly something that I think researchers are trying to get a handle on and understanding what attracts these children to this media and what do these effects look like.
And I guess what parents want to know, is this bad for my kid? If my kid is watching TV, or even if it's geared toward that age group, is it going to hurt them?
I think that's a really reasonable question that parents have. And what I typically try to tell parents, often they'll ask me how much. Give me an estimate. What's okay? It's really hard to give any set estimates on how much media. I really focus on the quality of media and having parents think about, does it seem to align with their values? Does it feel okay to them? Some media we're seeing really plays a really healthy role in kids' development, even very young children. I will also say, however, that particularly for our very young diaper demographic, and even our preschoolers, we see some concerns of background media. So when your child's in the room, if they're doing something else, turning the media off is certainly something I would recommend. But if they're using the media at that moment, whether it's a television show or an app or in a game, and it's developmentally appropriate and something that you as a parent feel comfortable with, I feel pretty good about that.
So why turn it off? What's at risk there?
So when there's background media on in the room, and it's particularly media that's not for them, so often it might be parentally adult-directed content, what some of the studies are showing is it often affects the quality of the child's play. So, and it can really disrupt them. And that kind of makes sense when you think about how media is constantly trying to grab our attention. It's the look at me. There's noises, there's sounds, there's things that try to orient us to the screen. And if you're a little one and you're in the room playing and something's calling your attention, there's a lot of distraction and task shifting that happens.
So it's the kind of effect when you're out at a restaurant and there's one of those huge TVs right above your table and everyone stops talking and starts looking at the TV. Same thing?
It's exactly why I won't let my husband face the TV at dinner, because I know if we're at a restaurant, he's going to be watching the game instead of talking to me.
It's hard not to.
Yeah,
it is. It's right there. So what happens when children get a little older and, you know, they're not just watching Teletubbies hop around, but there are more narrative themes going on there. What happens with that kind of exposure?
We actually see a lot of benefits of a narrative-based television for children. When it's really well-designed content, children understand the narrative. They often, at this age, let's say in that 3 to 6 year age group, they really enjoy having it repeated over and over again. This is the age where parents will say, how many times can she possibly watch Frozen? This happens a lot. And narrative's a really healthy way for children to develop their story schema skills, their story understanding, and they really tend to enjoy it. Media is entertaining, and that's okay. It's a good thing.
And as part of this, you get into the frilly pink dress syndrome. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that is.
So what happens is during the preschool-aged years, what we see is children are trying to figure out their gender, and they're thinking of their gender identity. And there becomes a point where we often see, sometimes in spite of parents' best efforts otherwise, children really start to align very strongly with a particular gender. We see this gender rigidity happen, and we call it the pink frilly dress phenomenon, where suddenly you'll see little girls wanting to wear their princess dress all day long to the supermarket, to the store, wherever they're going. Mm-hmm. And it's just a moment when they're really identifying their gender. And this often influences their media preferences as well. So the shows they want to watch, the games they want to play, the toys they want to purchase, things of that sort.
So what comes first? Does the pink frilly dress come first, or does the media steering them toward the pink frilly dress comes first?
That's a really good question. We're still trying to understand exactly how gender identity emerges in many ways. Typically, we see that gender is more predictive of media preferences, but it certainly has the potential to have a reinforcing effect. This is also why it's really beautiful when you can see new media that are trying to show different ideas of what gender is and creating more varied spaces for gender. It's also why I really enjoy some digital media where children can design their own avatar and for themselves decide what being a girl might look like or being a boy might look like. And so I think that media plays a powerful role in gender identity.
Well, we're talking right now with Jessica Taylor-Petrowski about the ways that media like the internet can influence children. She's an associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and the co-author of the new book we're discussing today. It's called Plugged In, How Media Attract and Affect Youth.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about children and the media? If you're a teacher or a parent, what are you seeing in your home, in your classroom, from the other kids your kid plays with? Are they communicating with each other more and more at older ages? Digitally? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation about how media like TV, the internet, social media influence children. And we're speaking now with Jessica Taylor-Petrowski. She's the co-author of the new book, Plugged In, How Media Attract and Affect Youth.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, what concerns do you have about your children and their exposure to technology and social media? Are there rules in your household? What are those rules? Are they followed strictly? If you're a teacher, what do you see with kids? More and more technology in the classroom, the kids' own, or the educationally endorsed technology? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And before we get to our calls, Jessica, I want to talk a little bit about teenagers, because I think that's an area that can be frightening to parents and to society as a whole. We think teenagers sometimes seem really absorbed in their media, their phone, their texting. We hear about cyberbullying cases, again, about sort of antisocial behavior. Is any of that founded? What do we know?
So I will say that, yes, some of these concerns are absolutely true. Things like cyberbullying, sexual grooming, or child grooming, as we call it, absolutely do occur, unfortunately. And the effects of this are real. They're incredibly concerning, and they're things we need to work on as a society to really eliminate. I will also say that it happens to a very small percentage of our tweens and teens. So to sort of allay some parent fears, it is very rare, but it is incredibly important. What we see, though, interestingly enough, is those children that are unfortunately affected by this, they tend to be children who are also dealing with bullying, for example, offline. They also tend to be children in the tweens and teens in the online space who might friend someone they don't know, so strangers, for example, or post particular images and things that are particularly evoking negative reactions, for example, which says to me, this is actually something we can help teens. We can actually talk to teens in our lives and help them think about safe social media use. There is actually ways to sort of mitigate some of these negative consequences.
And we'll talk more about the mitigation in just a bit. But first, let's take a phone call. We've got Dane joining us from Menominee. Dane, hi.
Hi. So I was pretty interested about your earlier comment with the perception of ADD and depression and anxiety. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on how media has allowed youth to access more language and how those words and our, you know, understanding of words changes the way we view the world. And I'll take the comment on the air.
Dane, thanks for that. And taking that language part of the question, what about the language that we use on the internet and the world, in a way, the world building that that creates, does that affect how someone might perceive and understand the world?
Well, there's two things with language. So on the one hand, from the younger generation, what we know is that media can actually be a very powerful vocabulary tool, an actual language tool for young children. There's numerous studies that have shown that media can provide an input, particularly when kids are growing up maybe in households or in social environments where maybe there's lower literacy skills. It can really be a very interesting supplemental opportunity for children. So I think that's from a more basic language learning. And then in terms about the language we use and what we share with others, there's a lot of work on what we call expression effects. This idea that how we share what we say about ourselves, for example, in social media, thinking about teens, for example, what they might say, it not only makes them think about themselves and can affect them, but it also affects their peer network. So we do really see a very powerful role about how they share information about themselves and how that affects both the teen and their peer network.
Well, thank you for that call. And let's take another call now from Eddie joining us in Madison. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, thank you. I just had a quick, I guess, question. I have a son who's 13 who watches YouTube all the time. I guess with YouTube, what is your opinion on, for example, so if he's watching a video game or something like that, you know, somebody streaming, and then that video and the next video, just because it has keywords that are similar, may come up, it may not be appropriate. And I see a lot of that.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering what your opinion is for how that would affect the child. And
mm-hmm. Eddie, thank you for that question. I appreciate that. And it is sort of set up to help you, in a way, binge watch videos, and not just YouTube, not to pick on them, but it seems as though the content is endless and it's hard to know. You may have selected one but not the other. So how do you mediate that as a parent?
Well, actually, this comment of that I'm hearing is actually, Eddie, this is your child's not strange at all in this. This is really common. I'm hearing this a lot with our tween and teen audience right now. This is incredibly challenging because we're dealing in a space where it's very hard to know what that next video is going to be. I would love to say, don't worry about it, but that's not true. In fact, often some of the content on places like YouTube and other sites like this, there is content that parents might not be comfortable with. One of the things I can say is if it's possible for you to be in the same space when your child is using it, so if they're consuming YouTube on the iPad and you're in the room while maybe you're cooking dinner, to keep an ear out for that. And then if something comes up that's inappropriate, having a real conversation with your teen or tween and being able to explain why this maybe is inappropriate and what you and coming up with some rules about how to handle that together. So you're really valuing your child's autonomy in this situation. But it's not really that easy to restrict this content.
Thanks a lot for that call, Eddie. And Jessica, you were talking earlier about ways to work on mitigating the negative effects of media, including social media. What do you suggest as the expert here? What should parents do?
Well, I think sometimes there's lots of different ways to approach parenting, of course. And one of the things we've done is try to understand how parents approach media in the home. And what we see over and over again is that when parents try to restrict media, although this can work reasonably well with younger children, as kids get older, restriction doesn't tend to work so well. We kind of create a forbidden fruit situation, and kids will find the content. We also see that parents will often use it as a reward, and then there's sort of an inconsistency in this. So I'm taking your smartphone away, but then I'm going to give it back, or I'm going to allow this, and then I'm not. And then often there's sort of a, I know I'll be able to use this anyway. But there's a different way of doing it where you sort of support a child's autonomy. We call it autonomy supportive parenting, where together you sort of work with your teen or tween to come up with some media rules as a family that you all feel comfortable with. And when that happens, we tend to see much more ways of encouraging positive use of media and mitigating the negative effects.
Can you leave us with some of those silver linings? What have you seen that's encouraging about maybe media and developing sense of self among teenagers, maybe healthy conceptions of sexuality instead of the negatives that we hear about, and education and learning? What are some of those positives?
Well, I think there's just so many sunny sides of media. And when we are living in a world now where our teens, for example, some estimates suggest are using up to 9 hours of media per day, I think it's comforting when we are able to see, okay, there's a lot of evidence that things like gaming can be supporting friendships, creativity, curiosity, working memory. There's evidence that social media is helping friendship formation and identity development. There's evidence that educational media, when used particularly to augment teacher instruction in the classroom or in the home environment, really works. So I don't want parents to feel guilty. I don't want parents to feel fear. I want them to see media as an opportunity. I want them to also see it as something that does require careful attention. It is part of our young people's lives. It's something that we need to consistently be thinking about and asking questions about. But we also have to be realistic that it's part of teens and kids' lives today, and we can learn to work with it and actually really benefit from it.
So positives on the future. Are there any exciting things that you're looking forward to research-wise, just briefly?
I'm really looking forward to seeing where virtual reality goes. I think we have a lot of opportunities for that. So
for children and adults.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of interest. I think there's caution that we have to think about. We need to approach it carefully. But I really think there's a lot of interesting things ahead.
Jessica, thank you so much for coming into the studio today and joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Jessica Taylor Petrowski. She joined us today to talk about the effect that media and technology have on children. She's an associate professor at the Department of Communication Science in the University of Amsterdam, and she co-authored the book we've been discussing today. It's called Plugged In: How Media Attract and Affect Youth.